Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and then in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to be examining German corporate purchases in the United States and some of the political and sociological implications of the same, primarily political. We're going to begin by taking a look at a very important article that was researched for us by a listener. The following, and once again, research credit to a listener, is from Vanity Fair Magazine's issue of June of 1998. This is Vanity Fair, June of 1998. And by the way, for those not familiar with the publication Vanity Fair, it's by no means a leftist publication by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, it's very mainstream, and as I recall, it's owned by Condé Nast Publications, not a leftist publisher by any stretch of the imagination. So keep that in mind as you listen to the following. This is an article, once again, from Vanity Fair's issue of June of 1998, entitled The German Front. And it's subtitled, As Bertelsmann Acquires Random House, the rival German media empire, the $2 billion George von Holtzbrinck Publishing Group, which since 1985 has bought Henry Holt, St. Martin's Press, and Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, is contending with disillusionment, infighting, and the owner's family's dark past. The author of this article is David Margolick, M-A-R-G-O-L-I-C-K. And by the way, in addition to those properties, Holtzbrinck also owns, manages, you know, they own Scientific American as well. Regular listeners to this program have heard about her discussion of the Bertelsmann Corporation's purchase of Random House Incorporated. Bertelsmann is one of the German core corporations, and by purchasing Random House Incorporated, they are now the largest English-language publisher in the world, and their sales volume is roughly double that of any other English-language publishing organization in the world. And bear in mind, that's Bertelsmann. What we're also going to hear about in this article is the von Holtzbrinck Publishing Group, which also is making major acquisitions in the United States. Once again, this article is called The German Front, and it reads in part as follows. America may never have been invaded by a foreign power, but without many people noticing, a crucial component of American culture has fallen almost entirely into foreign hands. Books. Of the big publishing companies, only three are still owned by Americans. Time Warner, William Morrow, and Simon & Schuster, and the last, perhaps, not for long, since the company is said to be on the block. By the way, it was eventually purchased by a British publishing corporation. I believe it was the Pearson Company. Continuing. HarperCollins is owned by Rupert Murdoch's Australian-based News Corporation, Viking Penguin, and Putnam by the English conglomerate Pearson. Everything else has been bought by a people who at one point in this century were more famous for burning books than for publishing them, the Germans. Last March, the conglomerate of Bertelsmann AG electrified the American literary world by buying from Advance Publications, which owns this magazine, the venerable publisher Random House, which includes Knopf, Crown, Ballantine, Fawcett, Times Books, Villard, and Pantheon, thereby vastly expanding an empire that already included the once independent houses of Bantam, Doubleday, Dell, and Delacorte. The purchase, for a reported $1.4 billion, made Bertelsmann the largest non-textbook publisher in America. It is now the publisher of such American literary icons as Norman Mailer and John Updike, and such commercial powerhouses as Anne Rice and Michael Crichton. But the German blitzkrieg of American book publishing doesn't end there. More quietly, but just as insistently, a second German media conglomerate has amassed its own considerable stake in the business. It is wholly owned by three siblings from Stuttgart who are nearly as mysterious in their native country as they are in the United States. They are the von Holtzbrinks. In American publishing these days, they are the other Germans. And skipping down, talking about some of the acquisitions of the von Holtzbrink Publishing Company. Since 1985, the Holtzbrinks have pumped at least $300 million into the United States and quietly acquired three of New York's premier book publishing houses, Henry Holt & Company, St. Martin's Press, and the most glittering jewel, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Already, Dieter von Holtzbrinck, already Dieter has made waves and raised doubts in the U.S. by appointing a brash German publisher for Holt, Michael Naumann, N-A-U-M-A-N-N. Naumann's urbane style has charmed people outside the company, but his abrasiveness as a boss has driven out many in the upper echelons of Holt. And skipping down, about yet another key von Holtzbrinck publication, or acquisition, I should say, also a publication. Then, for nearly $53 million, he bought Scientific American, beating out competing bids from, among others, English press lord Robert Maxwell. And again, that referring to the acquisition of the publication Scientific American. And by the way, there have been complaints since the von Holtzbrinck Group took over Scientific American that it's being dumbed down. The next section of the magazine article, once again Vanity Fair, June of 98, deals with George von Holtzbrinck's activities during the war years and during the Hitler period. George von Holtzbrinck was the fellow who was the founding scion, I guess you could say, of this particular publishing house, the von Holtzbrinck Publishers. Asked about George's activities during the Nazi years, the family grows even more reticent than usual. The Holtzbrinks usually depict the paterfamilias almost as a member of the resistance, noting how, in 1938, the Reichspressekammer, or Nazi press bureau, had found him unreliable and stripped him of his license. One executive at Scientific American recalled how Dieter reduced his family's wartime experiences to the fact that an Allied bomb had destroyed the family home. Monica Scholler, S-C-H-O-E-L-L-E-R, to her credit, is more candid, saying that her father joined the Nazi party, but she insists it was a matter of survival rather than of conviction, and something he later rued. That presentation of George von Holtzbrinck's Nazi Party career is, as we shall see in a moment, altogether revisionist. In fact, George von Holtzbrinck, was an enthusiastic Nazi and collaborated with the Nazis from an early date. And he then proceeded to give out-of-work Nazis, including at least one notorious SS man, key positions in his post-World War II firm. Of the reality of the Nazi career of George von Holtzbrinck, as opposed to the sanitized version presented by his heirs, we read, Nazi Party records show, however, that George joined as a Nazi student group in 1931, 2 years before Hitler came to power, and, according to the Bundesarchive, joined the Nazi Party itself in May of 1933, only 2 months after the Nazi takeover and before there was great pressure to do so. He remained in it for all of the 1,000-year Reich, that is, 12 years. His, quote, unreliability, unquote, stemmed not from opposition to the regime, it seems, but from his wish to run his business free from government interference. Far from being blackballed, George managed to operate or own several publishing companies throughout the Nazi years, including one that produced books for German soldiers, a profitable enterprise with 9 million men in uniform. His company also published 4 Nazi-sanctioned magazines with titles neatly capturing the distinctive Nazi argot, Freude der Arbeit, The Joy of Labor, Schönheit der Arbeit, The Beauty of Labor, Kolonie und Heimat, Colony and Homeland, and Berlin, Rome, Tokyo, a publication officially approved by the German Foreign Ministry. George's party ties were serious enough to be scrutinized after the war by a German denazification court. A prosecutor accused him of being a convinced follower of the National Socialist Authoritarian Dictatorship, unquote, and produced 2 witnesses from the book business, one of whom stated, quote, As far as I can judge, von Holtzbrinck was a good Nazi, and above all, a profiteer who made a lot of money through sole management of various Nazi periodicals, unquote. And skipping down about George von Holtzbrinck's post-war career, we read, quote, Holtzbrinck was not a Nazi war criminal, but he cleverly took advantage of a favorable economic situation, he wrote in a letter to me. He, by the way, is Siegfried Lukatis, an historian at the Center for Contemporary History and Research in Potsdam. That, of course, in Germany. Beginning again, quote, Holtzbrinck was not a Nazi war criminal, but he cleverly took advantage of a favorable economic situation, he wrote in a letter to me. Compared to that, the fact that he didn't give the Hitler salute seems, to me, almost meaningless, unquote. German publisher Klaus Wagenbach, W-A-G-A-N-B-A-C-H, believes that Holtzbrinck subsequently filled his sales force with former Nazis who, because they were ostensibly barred from the book industry, could be had cheap, a charge that Holtzbrinck spokesperson Arno Mahlert denies. Moreover, the man in charge of one of George's post-war magazines was a notorious former SS trooper who had once worked for Joseph Goebbels. So, once again, note that a major force now in American publishing is the von Holtzbrinck Company, not only founded and run by an ardent Nazi, but an individual who carried on some of his Nazi affiliations well into the post-World War II period. And bear in mind, this is as the Bertelsmann Corporation has now become the largest English-language publishing house in the world, and between the two of them, they will exert a profound influence on American culture and intellectual life in the future. I look at this against the background of a Nazi tract that I have discussed many times on this program and that I'm going to discuss again. I apologize to those listeners for whom this will appear tedious and or repetitive, but it's important, I think, to emphasize the seriousness of what's going on and also the fact that this obscure Nazi tract is not at all unimportant. The book, as veteran listeners may have guessed, is called Serpent's Walk, authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall, C-A-L-V-E-R-H-A-L-L. The book was published in softcover, by National Vanguard Books. That's the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important domestic Nazi group. Their address, and please be aware, I think this is a very important book to study, but it is a Nazi tract and enthusiastically pro-Nazi, and this publishing house, National Vanguard Books, is a Nazi publisher. These are not the Boy Scouts of America, so I urge extreme caution, with a capital E and a capital C, to anyone who deals with them. This book, again, is published by National Vanguard Books. Their post office box is 330 Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946. The ISBN number is 0-937-944-05-X. And the book could be summed up by what's on the back cover. Reading the back cover of Serpent's Walk, the good guys win sometimes. Not always, of course. They lost big in the Second World War. That war was a victory for communists, Democrats, and Jews. But everyone else lost, including millions of GIs who were told that they were killing Germans and Japanese in order to make the world a decent place for their children to grow up, only to see things in America go from bad to much, much worse in the decades after the war. Even when the bad guys win, they sometimes grow careless and later become losers. Look what happened to the communists of Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Could the same thing happen to their erstwhile World War II allies in America? Serpent's Walk explores that possibility. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. In this book, the descendants of the SS, in addition to building up this capital organization and buying into the American opinion-forming media, please note that, they infiltrate the United States Army, and following a biological warfare attack with genetically engineered viruses, ostensibly of Russian origin, an attack which wipes out much of the U.S. population, including the president and vice president, the Speaker of the House then becomes President of the United States and invites the Nazi front group called the Party of Humankind into a governing coalition, and the Nazis take over the United States. This is supposed to happen in the mid-21st century. And by the way, they work with a black American Muslim named Khalifa, who is setting up a homeland for African Americans who want to leave America. He gets funded by the Nazis, and he takes part in this Nazi takeover. The reason I think this book is so important is that it is based certainly on fact. In fact, the SS did go underground and through the Reinhard Galen spy outfit, gained a profound access to the American national and political national security and political establishments through the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic component of an underground Reich. They did indeed begin forming a profound economic presence in the world, and I believe that this book is far more than the novel that it purports to be. I believe it is a blueprint for what is happening and what is going to happen in the future. Hence my emphasis on it. And please note the von Holtzbrinck and Bertelsmann acquisitions in the United States, buying into the opinion-forming media. This is extremely important. With their role in publishing, this will give Germans the dominant role in American publishing in years to come. I would also note that German corporations are invading the American market, not just in terms of producing goods for American consumers, but in terms of purchasing major American corporations, and they are doing this in a big, big way. As I speak at the tail end of May of 1998, recent business headlines, in fact recent headlines, have been garnered by the acquisition of the Chrysler Corporation by Daimler-Benz, a major German automotive manufacturer, and the manufacturer of the world-famous Mercedes-Benz. An op-ed column in the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, May 13th of 1998, discusses this merger, the merger between Chrysler and Daimler-Benz. A merger belongs in quotes. This is an op-ed column by Robert Reno, R-E-N-O, who's a Newsday columnist, and it reads, Chrysler, quote, merger, unquote, looks like a foreign takeover, unquote. And it reads in part, Wall Street and the automotive world were caught flat-footed last week by the largest industrial merger in history. Most experts, analysts, industry observers, competitors, all the usual suspects, confessed they'd not had Chrysler Corporation and Daimler-Benz anywhere near the top of their most likely to marry lists, skipping down. I'm not even going to tell you some of the tasteless jokes I've already heard out of Michigan. The first time Shrimp, the head of Daimler-Benz, the first time Shrimp, S-C-H-R-E-M-P-P, has to close down one of Chrysler's underperforming U.S. operations, a job he has performed with cool ruthlessness at Daimler-Benz, you can just imagine all the howling about who made the tanks that won World War II. And, skipping down, they can also, of people who have been observing this merger critically, they can also see a change of nationality for a corporation that, as recently as 1980, was thought so indispensable to the U.S. manufacturing base that Congress took the extraordinary step of guaranteeing loans that saved it from bankruptcy. If at that time anyone had suggested that the U.S. government was fattening up Chrysler so it could be fed to the Germans in 1998, Congress would have had a fit. 18 years later, even after Japanese and German auto companies have established manufacturing beachheads in the United States and been welcomed in job-starved communities in the South, Chrysler's expatriation will infuriate raving nativists such as Pat Buchanan. Another thing that made this merger improbable is that there are no obvious immediate savings to be made from firing large numbers of people at Daimler Chrysler. The two companies do not have major overlapping operations that make the new company ripe for downsizing. This may be a comfort to workers of the German and American components of Daimler, but it means this deal is sadly lacking in the factor that so often makes these huge mergers so attractive to investors and so frightening to employees. And in weeks to come, we're going to be discussing some of the probable effects of the establishment of the euro. In fact, if that turns out to be a weak currency, and many observers feel it will, that could very easily lead to the closing down of manufacturing facilities in the United States in favor of those in Europe, because American manufactured products would become prohibitively expensive to consumers in other countries. I would note that just as American corporations are moving manufacturing facilities to parts of the U.S. That have lower wage scales and beyond that to foreign countries that have even lower wage scales, German corporations are doing the same thing. They're purchasing American corporations, corporations in other countries, and they're moving manufacturing facilities to other parts of Europe and the world that have lower wages than the very, very high wages and excellent benefits traditionally paid to German workers. This while Germany is suffering record unemployment, unemployment which is fueling the rise of the reemergence of Nazism in Germany. And I think that the cynicism of German corporations and the cynicism of American corporations are equivalent and are likely to prove extremely destructive worldwide. More about the Mercedes purchase of Chrysler. This also an op-ed column, and this from the San Jose Mercury News of the same day as that Chronicle column, Wednesday, May 13th of 1998. This is an op-ed column by Joel D. Joseph, who is chairman of the Made in the USA Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting American products in the United States and overseas. This op-ed column reads as follows. Mercedes gobbled up Chrysler almost as quickly as Hitler's troops conquered Poland. Now, Mercedes has turned its aggression toward Nissan, seeking to take over its diesel truck division. We must stop Mercedes in its tracks because its actions are clearly anti-competitive, and its power could ultimately be used to the detriment of workers in the United States. Further, Mercedes has received Chrysler for a fraction of what it is really worth. Most observers have found overall benefit to the Mercedes takeover of Chrysler. It will help Chrysler gain a foothold in Europe, we are told. And to gain this marketing benefit in Europe, the two huge auto companies did not have to merge. They could enter into a joint marketing agreement like many airlines have. Under such an agreement, Chrysler Jeeps and minivans could be sold in Mercedes dealerships in Europe. This type of agreement would have the benefits without the downside of the proposed merger. One day after signing the takeover papers, Mercedes officials announced its intention to call off its plans for a Mercedes minivan. This action clearly demonstrates that Mercedes' takeover of Chrysler will lessen competition in the auto industry. This mega-merger violates the antitrust laws of the United States. Because of this reduction in... This mega-merger violates the antitrust laws of the United States. Because of this reduction in competition for the minivan market and the sport utility vehicles business. Mercedes already directly competes with Chrysler in the sale of sport utility vehicles. Mercedes produces the M-Class in Alabama, while Chrysler manufactures the Dodge Durango in Delaware and the Jeep Grand Cherokee in Michigan. This merger will reduce competition for trucks and automobiles and should be opposed by the Federal Trade Commission and the Justice Department. Historically, mergers of this type have resulted in increased prices and large-scale worker layoffs. Several years from now, we may regret that decisions in American plant closings are made in Stuttgart, not in Detroit. The victorious corporation is Daimler-Benz, the parent of Mercedes-Benz. Daimler-Benz shareholders will own 57% of the new corporation to be called Daimler-Chrysler. But is this domination fair? Chrysler earned substantially more profits than Mercedes last year. Chrysler earned $2.8 billion, while Mercedes earned only $1.76 billion after taxes. Mercedes has been misleading the press by releasing its pre-tax profits of $2.4 billion while disclosing Chrysler's after-tax profits. It has been Mercedes-Benz that has had a rocky few years, not Chrysler. As recently as 1995, Mercedes suffered an annual loss of 7 billion Deutschmarks, about $5 billion. Yet it is Mercedes that will receive the majority of the new corporation. Based on profits, and that is what capitalism is all about, Chrysler should have bought Mercedes. The price-earnings ratio for Chrysler at the merger price is less than half of the same ratio for Mercedes. In other words, Mercedes got Chrysler at a bargain basement price. Skipping down, in the long run, thousands of workers on both sides of the Atlantic will be fired. That is how these mergers save money, by getting rid of highly paid workers. What happens 3 years from now when the U.S. dollar is strong and the euro becomes weak? American auto workers are likely to be fired. Several years back, Thomson Electronics, a French company, bought RCA, the American television manufacturer. The same people cheering on the Mercedes acquisition of Chrysler thought that RCA would become stronger and more competitive with a European parent. But just 2 months ago, Thomson moved RCA from Indiana to Mexico, firing thousands of well-paid American workers. Chrysler could suffer the same fate. Why make Chryslers in Michigan when Mexican workers are willing to put the vehicles together for a dollar an hour? If Chrysler had bought Mercedes, the European Union would turn down the merger as anti-competitive. The United States should oppose the merger as a violation of our antitrust laws. The Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission should proceed immediately to investigate the acquisition and prepare to stop it in court. Indeed, I think a number of important points are made in that particular op-ed column. The euro is now coming into being. That is going to be a profoundly important event, and if it is indeed a weak currency, then it could very strongly adversely affect the American economy. There's a half-hour segment available from Spitfire about the European Monetary Union as the realization of the pan-Germanic theories of Friedrich Liest, who advocated a German-dominated European Union as a vehicle for world conquest and unseating Great Britain as the dominant power in the world, which it was in the 1840s. Now the dominant power in the world is, of course, the United States. More about this particular merger, again, the takeover of Chrysler by Daimler-Benz, was carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, May 7th of 1998. This is a New York Times story, Dateline Detroit, headlined, Mercedes Ready to Buy Chrysler. subtitled Biggest Industrial Takeover in History. This is authored by Edmund L. Andrews and Laura M. Holson, and it's datelined Detroit. And skipping down in the article, there's a very telling paragraph here which reads, speaking of the takeover, It also gives the German company production capacity outside Germany, where worker wages and benefits are among the most expensive in the world. It further offers Daimler-Benz an opportunity to learn from Chrysler's envied process of making decisions quickly and bringing new vehicles to market promptly, attributes that have become more important as competition in the auto industry has escalated. Well, by the way, this, as the previous op-ed column pointed out, is going to reduce competition in the automobile industry. And as workers, highly paid workers, are fired on whatever side of the Atlantic, we are already seeing a tendency to scapegoat people of color, minorities, quote, immigrants, unquote, for the economic problems, very real problems, of those workers. I would point out that the influence of the American automobile industry on German auto manufacturers is by no means new. And lest I be thought anti-German, I want to remind listeners that I've pointed out many times and in many broadcasts available from Spitfire that American industry and finance played a profound role in the rise of Hitler and the arming of the Third Reich. One of the earliest of Hitler's supporters was Henry Ford, and along with another fellow, Charles Badeau, B-E-D-A-U-X, a GM executive who instituted the feared speed-up program, and who also, by the way, was an ardent fascist and supporter of Adolf Hitler, and one of the reputed participants in the 1934 coup attempt to overthrow Roosevelt. The influence of American fascist automobile manufacturers, such as the pro-Hitler Henry Ford and the pro-Hitler Charles Badeau, wielded a profound influence on German auto manufacturing, and one of the first companies to institute that was Daimler-Benz, with the merger of two companies. This is discussed in a very good book entitled Daimler-Benz in the Third Reich. That book was authored by Neil Greger, G-R-E-G-O-R, and we're going to discuss the American and fascist American influence on the German auto industry in a minute. This book is copyright 1998. It's published in hardcover by the Yale University Press of New Haven and London, and the ISBN number is 0-300-07-07243-0. And of the influence of Henry Ford and Charles Badeau on the German auto industry, we read, while the phrase itself, this is called the reception of Fordism by the German automobile industry. While the phrase itself was a novelty in the 1920s, the basic aim underlying the concept of industrial rationalization in the context of an economy organized on capitalist principles, the maximization of private profit, reflected the primary purpose of industrial management since the emergence of the industrial capitalist economy itself. The ongoing process of optimizing the development of technology, labor, and time, and the relationship between all three in any given economic and political situation, was in this sense nothing new. It was in the 1920s, however, under the influence of new forms of factory organization and management that had recently been developed in America, that the phrase became associated with an integrated vision of technological, economic, and social development, which would encompass and indeed define the whole of society. The Fordist-Taylorist paradigm of technical and operational rationalization, based on mass production techniques first introduced at the Highland Park factory of Ford Motor Company, and on the scientific management of Taylor, Badeau, and others, combined the promise of increased efficiency and profits with a propagandistic vision of social progress. And skipping down, perhaps not surprisingly, the automobile industry was one of the first to recognize the potential of the new forms of production being pioneered in America, and in some way or another, all companies in the sector moved toward a system of management in which, in principle, the group producing motors produces one motor in regular tempo in the same time as the group producing rear axles produces one rear axle. We're going to continue with this discussion in the next half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.